Thursday, April 28th, 1977, room 346, 3 p.m. Public hearing on Senate Bill 1073, House Bills 2252, 2253,
and 2254, and Senate Bill 60.
No one here.
They're all out in the hall. They're congregating in the hall.
Exists only so long as assets remain.
This, of course, has been a very attractive form of fundraising for the religious education and other charitable trusts. As a consequence of this, there was considerable activity generated by the trust soliciting this type of donation, this trust donation. In much of this literature, indications, representations were made as to the investment abilities and all of those handling these funds on behalf of the charities, that they had people of substantial business skills, knowledge, security analysts, that type of thing, making representations as to their ability to continue this lifetime income. When this developed, our office took the position that these trusts, it's really a combination of investment and gift, in our view. And it was our position that this solicitation of this constituted the sale of a security, that the trust arrangement was an investment contract, a profit-sharing agreement, and so came under the securities law. Now, there was a divergence of opinion among the security lawyers whether or not an interest in a trust is a security. We have, in the Oregon law, we do not exempt securities issued by non-profit or charitable corporations. We have had substantial history of problems with religious and other charities offering securities, and so have not supported any such amendment. Now, the question of whether or not a trust interest would constitute the sale of a security was created a few years ago. We brought suit against an evangelist from Ohio, Rex Humboldt. He was offering certificates of indebtedness to residents of the state without registration. He got into financial difficulties. We became aware of the offering and were able to obtain a refund from the Oregon investors. Subsequent to that, then his organization went into a bankruptcy reorganization. About one of the alternatives that he had considered to the certificates here were the trust agreements. And we took the position at that time that it was a security, and suit was filed. However, the matter was settled before the question was totally litigated. We've had other problems. Now, in the Rex Humboldt case, in the case of Church Service Plan, which involved some $9 million of investment, neither of those cases was it a fraud in the conventional sense of that term. It was simply a matter of financial difficulties and desperation moves to try to correct those, and the interests of the investors were not being protected. Now, in both of those instances, after the receivership, then the investment was, the investors were made whole. So for this reason, we feel that the securities law should have application. Now, in the last session of the legislature, I proposed the language that is set forth on lines 25 to 28 of Senate Bill 60 that takes out of the definition of a security a voluntary interest in an individual's trust. The reason I put that in was to clarify the question that always arises in connection with conventional trust activity of licensed trust companies and the creation of trusts for many different individual reasons. Now, I feel that the language that we proposed in the last session is too broad, has gone too far. Now, coupled with the amendment that was made in the last session, we also dealt with this question of the charitable trust. We amended our exemption section to provide that if the charitable trust meant the requirements of rules and regulations to be developed by the commissioner, then the trust, the position of these trusts, would be exempt from the registration requirements of the securities law. Now, I think there's an important matter to bear in mind. Exemption from registration does not exempt the offeror of the security from the fraud provisions of the Oregon securities law. At this time, I propose Senate Bill 60 to delete the language. My original proposal was to delete the language set forth on lines 25 through 28. This was unacceptable to the bank, state and national banks. They felt that while it was legislation that we had proposed, that they didn't want to give that up. So I have met with them, and we have agreed that we would retain the language in lines 25 to 28.
What page is that?
Page 5. That we would then add to that that the provisory voluntary interest in the New Orleans Trust is not a security, provided that a corporate trustee licensed to do business in this state is acting as trustee. If not, then the exemption is not available. So the situation as proposed in this amendment of April 14th will result in this following situation, Madam Chairperson. If the solicitation of these trusts are outside of the securities law, provided that a trust company is the trustee, that is, a regulated institution is acting as trustee. If a charity intends to act as trustee itself and is not going to utilize the services of a regulated institution, then the solicitation and offering of each trust is subject to registration and does come under the provisions of the securities law. Now, such trusts can avoid the burdens of registration if their program conforms to the rules adopted under the exemption. And those rules substantially include provisions of the Internal Revenue Code, which regulates to some extent activities that can be carried on by the trustee. So I don't feel that this amendment that's proposed here creates any burden on charitable or nonprofit corporations. It simply states that if they want to solicit this business, then they can be completely out of the open securities law if they use a regulated trustee. If they act as trustees themselves, then they're exempt from the registration requirements if they comply with our rules. If not, then they are required to register that activity. And I think that's substantially this language in the amendment of April 14th has been reviewed by the attorneys for the banks and the state banks, and I think that concludes my testimony. Any questions?
Senator Brown.
Mr. Healy has this proposed amendment to the voluntary intervival of trust been reviewed with the attorneys for any of the large religious organizations that I gather have been using this as a money raising?
It has. Now we have Terry Pantos, who in this case represents, I've forgotten whether it's the U.S. or international, but he also has handled the registrations for Reed and Willamette and some of the universities that have used it. So therefore, he represents certain of those colleges, and Terry has been close to this whole question. So he was reviewed it, and I have reviewed it with Mr. Jim Hobbs and Glenn Patterson, who I think Glenn is here today. I don't know what their position is, but I have reviewed it with him.
Further questions? Diana?
Commissioner Healy, under your language, does the corporation need to be a corporation which is authorized to conduct trust business in the state, or can it be any corporation?
You know, it has to be a corporation authorized to conduct a trust business in any state, so that it comes under the superintendent of banks or under the controller of the currency.
Further questions? Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank you.
Glenn Patterson.
Madam Chairman, I have Jim Hobbs, our attorney witness here. I asked him to be here. I didn't sign his name on there because I wasn't sure that he was going to arrive, but he is here. And we were with the committee 2 years ago when this law that we are considering amending today would put in. We had quite a little discussion with Mr. Healy and were opposed to it until after we talked to the Attorney General's office and discussed the situation with them and decided that the language that was placed in there by Mr. Healy, if properly interpreted, would be all right. And there were some here on this committee today who were on the committee then. And we went along with it, although we didn't really think it was the very best that would be possible, but it has worked all right thus far. We really feel that it would be best to leave it as it is, unless there's some very definite reason and problem that is involved since that time. And we feel that there is a change in definition to where you're making a trust a security. And we just like to keep by the dictionary a little bit more closely. Mr. Hopps has prepared a statement of my request, and I'll ask him to present it before you.
Yes.
Thank you. Forgive me, I wasn't sure I was going to make it either this afternoon. I have prepared a written statement, which I would be happy to pass out. I have an original for the clerk and several copies for the members of the committee. This was prepared basically with the bill as it was originally written in mind. This original bill we did discuss with Commissioner Healy. However, I must confess that Mr. Healy's most recent change I have only seen just within the last couple of minutes after I came into the room here. Basically, I guess I'm representing myself and the Seventh-day Adventist Church, which is a religious organization and which does have a trust program as outlined by Commissioner Healy. The concepts of trust law and that of securities law are somewhat difficult to construe simultaneously with each other. You have terms like issuer, broker-dealer, and things of that nature, which in the, let's just speak in terms of religious connotation, is very difficult to rationalize the applications of two different types of concepts. Basically, the charitable remainder trusts, which are held by the average charity, are not large things. Quite often, banks don't really like to use, don't even like to handle them as trustees. I'm trying to, you know, make some other points other than what I wrote in my memorandum.
Let me interrupt just one second.
Sure.
Because the proposed amendment by Mr. Healy restores everything from lines, well, everything, restores the old language, deletes the new language, and then simply inserts a provision in line 25. So I guess my question is to you, Glenn, is the proposed amendment by Mr. Healy acceptable to you since all that language is being restored that Mr. Hopps is talking about?
We discussed that. I discussed that with Mr. Hopps. I don't believe I identified myself, and I do that now. I'm Benny Patterson with the Seventh-day Adventist Church Department of Public Affairs, Northwest Headquarters. We questioned where it says trust in the amendment that he's proposed is speaking about the first word trust that is placed in there.
I guess it is.
There are two in the line, and I wasn't positive, but I would think that's where it should fit. It says a beneficial interest in a voluntary inter vitals trust, the trustee of which is a corporation or national banking association authorized to conduct trust business in this state. The language is a bit confusing to me because I don't know whether that latter phrase is referring to both or only to the last. And so it makes a little bit of difference as far as we are concerned. If we're a corporation, if that's what it's referring to, it's all right. If the latter refers only to the National Banking Association, then perhaps he'd have no problem. Is that right, Jim?
Well, I think there are still some areas of concern, although it certainly helps a lot, I would believe.
Well, Matt Chairman, Senator Roberts, if we could ask Mr. Healy to clarify his intent in this proposal and how it would apply to the concerns of the witnesses before us, I think we'd save an awful lot of time and the testimony on the part of Mr. Hobbs. Mr. Healy, do you want to comment?
Yes, I think there's a misunderstanding here. The language that's suggested by this amendment would restrict the trustee to a trust company regulated by the bank, by the superintendent of banks, or a comptroller. That would not include a private corporation or the church organization that Mr. Patterson represents. While they're incorporated, they are not a corporation authorized to conduct a trust business in the state. So the only corporations that would be included in this would be those under the regulation of the superintendent of banks or the comptroller of the currency in the case of national banks.
That's what I suspected. If that's the case, then we are still concerned with the bill.
Did you have further comments, Mr. Hobbs?
Well, I just wanted to make just a couple of points, if I could, Madam Chairperson.
You direct them to the amendment, please.
Yes, ma'am, I will be pleased to do that. Number one, this new language would then limit a person, an individual, from being a trustee of a charitable trust without registering, which I think is something that might be of some concern to the committee. Secondly, the religious corporations, the educational corporations, and other charitable organizations which serve as trustees under a number of these trusts are very carefully regulated under the Internal Revenue Code. Those provisions within the code itself are extremely stringent and very strict. If they're not carefully followed, then the trust itself is disqualified from any tax consequences favorable to the donor, which is under standard trust concepts, I believe, a legitimate cause of action against the trustee under the commonly accepted trust law, both as it stood in England and the United States and the common law. So it's the feeling of this individual that the area sought to be regulated here is already legitimately and properly, I submit, regulated, that to blend the areas of securities and trusts would be to make some difficulty in both areas for religious organizations. I'm still not totally sure, Your Honor, that in the wrong forum.
You're all right. She's a judge too.
They're unsafe. It would appear to me that there might even still be some area of concern because I believe some religious organizations are, in their purposes clause at least, stated that they may receive by trustee or serve as executors of wills of individuals with charitable remainders. And so we might even have other areas that need to be determined. And I would, for one, submit two things. Number one, that to just leave the statute the way it's written today would possibly avoid some extensive litigation. Number two, there are some other individuals who I think would be very much interested in this type of legislation who I don't think have been notified. I spoke to Dean Scholes this morning on the phone. He used to be here today, and he may even still be here yet. I don't know. But he had some comments and thoughts about this bill. Basically the same, I think, and the same general nature as my own, but there's some question here with regard to blending the areas of trust and security. I also spoke this morning with Mr. Thompson Snyder, who is the Oregon State Bar Chairman for trust legislation. And because this language is couched in terms of the securities law, that committee itself had no knowledge of it. And I would submit that there are some far-reaching effects of this thing as they relate to the area of trust law that really need to be explored, and I think maybe this is a bit premature.
Questions over to Mr. Patterson and Mr. Hobbs. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can I ask one question?
Senator Carson.
In the time past,
you two gentlemen have met with Mr. Healy and resolved your differences. Have you made any attempts at this go around?
I didn't get this until this morning.
Quite frankly, we've never gone into this exact issue before. At times previous, I was under the impression that the commissioner had in mind a total exemption of the types of trusts that he mentioned to the committee. So I was not, you know, really quite prepared for the fact that this is, in fact, sought to be regulated.
Madam Chairman, it's not my place, and I don't know this committee, but I am familiar with 2 years ago we were at the same difficulty, and if I recall correctly, Mr. Hobbs and Mr. Patterson met with Mr. Healy or his representatives, and we worked out an agreement that at that time was supposed to got the job done. I wonder if it would be appropriate to recommend that they might visit again and see if there is any common ground, but there may not be this time. We may have to decide at this time, but I would hope that they could get together. Maybe that's just enough.
Yes, we'd appreciate it if you would, and if you would let me know then, please, the results of your conference.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Senate Bill 1073, Mike Fox.
My name is Michael Fox, and I live in Eugene, Oregon, and I'm an attorney. And this bill, 1073, was presented as my request. I spoke previously with Ms. Godwin about it, and that's how the ball got rolling. I have submitted an original letter to the clerk, and there are copies of the letter provided for each senator regarding this, and I'd like to direct my comments primarily to an amendment I proposed in the bill that now reads, because it's a bit unclear. The first amendment I suggest is as follows. In section 1 of the bill, the first sentence should read in pertinent part, the defendant may cross appeal when the state appeals pursuant to ORS 138.060. Now, this bill deals with cross appeals by defendants in criminal cases when the state appeals from an adverse ruling of a trial court. It's something that's not currently done under present law. The current situation is when there's a pre-trial omnibus hearing or a motion to suppress, and the state gets an adverse ruling, it can take it up to the Court of Appeals to see if they can get the trial judge straightened out. There are often a lot of issues litigated in pre-trial hearings, and the rulings can go either way for the state or for the defendant, but as the law currently reads, only the state can appeal a pre-trial ruling. This legislation arose out of a case that I tried before Judge Allen last year, and he was going to be up here today to testify, but he got stuck in a trial and couldn't make it. And it was a long and complicated omnibus hearing in which I think I raised about 7 issues, and Judge Allen ruled in my favor on about 4 or 5 of them, I can't recall the exact number, and ruled against me on 2. And the state appealed the suppression of the evidence in that particular case, took it up at the Court of Appeals, and in a subsequent conversation with Judge Allen, he says, Mike, why don't you, these are good issues that you raised, even though I ruled against you, why don't you cross-appeal them? And I looked into the statute and found that I couldn't. I called the public defender up who was going to handle this particular case, and he said that he couldn't. And it appears to me that it only makes good sense that when there is an appeal by the state from a pretrial ruling, that the defendant also be allowed to cross appeal. And and the reason for that is you can get all of the issues resolved by the Court of Appeals at one time. Under present law, yes.
Just a minute, send me around.
You said from a pretrial.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're talking about a conviction. Here.
Well,
are you talking about at any stage?
Well, now, as the law currently reads, the defendant can appeal only from a conviction. What I propose is that the defendant be allowed to appeal from a conviction if that results, or to cross appeal when the state is allowed to appeal. Now, the state is allowed to appeal only under a very limited set of circumstances. One, from adverse pretrial ruling suppressing evidence. Another one is from an order arresting judgment. And the third is from an order setting aside an indictment. Now, the defendant, of course, cannot appeal adverse pretrial rulings at all.
He has to wait until he is convicted. Then he litigates the whole issue at once. Everything that happened from the time he's indicted up to the time of conviction. The legislation I have proposed here does not allow the defendant to appeal a pretrial ruling. It only allows him to cross appeal when the state appeals.
Madam Chairman?
Senator Gavorian.
Now, if I understand this right, you would only be able to, when the prosecution appeals on the issues they lost.
That's right.
Then you would cross appeal on issues that
you lost in the same hearing, or maybe even in a prior pretrial hearing.
No, prior to either.
Okay.
No. Yes.
Well, Madam Chairman, point out to me then the provisions in the bill that relates to the pretrial appeal. Where is that?
Well, that's ORS 138.060 is the section which governs appeals by the state. Now, it may not be in the bill itself.
Okay, you've made a reference to it on page 2, down on line 32.
Right.
Okay, so that's it.
That's the cross-referencing provision right there.
All right.
Anyhow, let me proceed to read from my letter, and it might be a little bit more organized. In many criminal cases, the defendant files a motion to suppress evidence, and often either the state or the defendant requests an omnibus hearing. In either type of a hearing, a great many issues often are raised which must be decided by the trial judge. In the criminal case in which an issue regarding suppression of evidence is raised and the result is adverse to the defendant, the trial proceeds in the ordinary course of business. If conviction results, the defendant appeals pursuant to the current ORS 138.040 and can raise any court decision throughout the proceedings. Under existing law, the state can appeal only under a strict set of circumstances in order to avoid double jeopardy problems. One of these situations arises from an order made prior to trial suppressing evidence, which is found in ORS 138.060(3). Such an order results from a hearing on a motion to suppress or from an omnibus hearing. It is not unusual for rulings to be adverse both to the state and... All right, fine, Madam Chairman. Well, basically that's it. If the state is allowed to appeal from an adverse ruling pre-trial, the following situation can result. The case can be taken up to the Court of Appeals, and the Court of Appeals will reverse the trial judge. The trial judge then has the case remanded to him for trial. Let's suppose conviction results. On conviction, the defendant appeals, and he then raises issues that were litigated in the same pre-trial hearing that the state was allowed to appeal from the very outset. It's conceivable that the Court of Appeals could reverse the trial judge again on a pre-trial ruling that he made, then sending it back for a second trial. So we've got two appeals when one could have sufficed. If the defendant can cross appeal from an adverse pretrial ruling only when the state appeals, then the entire pretrial hearing can be litigated at once before the Court of Appeals, before any appellate court, necessitating only one appeal. I think that this sort of thing would result in a great saving of judicial time, because the whole pretrial hearing would be before the Court of Appeals at one time, and you would not have to have the possibility of two appeals and even the possibility of two trials.
Any questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Senator Roberts.
If you allow the cross appeal on pre-trial,
right,
then you go back to the trial and you get a conviction, then you appeal on the conviction, you cannot then raise again before the Court of Appeals any of those issues that were decided. That's
by the Court of Appeals?
Yes, because that's...
It's already been raised once.
Okay.
Well, I would presume that the following situation would obtain, that it would all be litigated at once. If the Court of Appeals rules a certain way, the state is offended, the one who's unhappy with the Court of Appeals ruling is going to petition for review at that time. And the Supreme Court's going to either grant or deny review, send it back to the Court of Appeals, mandate's going to issue, come back down to the trial court. Then, if there's enough evidence still to proceed with the trial before the jury will occur. Then I would anticipate that only those rulings made after the impaneling of the jury, if there's a conviction of result, would be appealable at that time.
Any further questions, Mr. Fox? Thank you very much.
Thanks very much, sir. Oh, I do have a letter from Judge Allen that I'd like to read into the record, and then I'll submit it to the clerk.
You can that's, just hand it out.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You hadn't told me? Huh?
We're looking for those kids that are drowning.
Uh-huh.
Buell Reservoir. Can't find them.
Yeah.
3 weeks ago, there were two boys drowned in Buell Reservoir, and we can't find them. Both of them or any sign.
Where's the reservoir?
It's about 15 miles north of Ventura.
Where's that? You can't get there from here.
No, that's between Burns and Bayham. 6 miles out of Burns.
How do they know they're drowned? I can't find any evidence of the
drowning. Well, he had swam away for help.
Oh.
And while he was gone, not 10 minutes, their boat went down, and they went down, and they can't find it. It never come up.
Hmm.
Can't find the boat. Can't find it. We can't get the Navy or the Air Force.
Or anybody to do anything. Hospital 2252. William Martin.
Chairperson, member of the Judiciary Committee. My name is William C. Martin, 2908 First National Bank Tower, Portland, Oregon. I'm Secretary of the Procedure and Practice Committee of the Oregon State Bar and a member of the Oregon State Bar. And I'm appearing on behalf of the bar in support of Hospital 2252. Although Oregon is liberalized, I have submitted to the Secretary, and I assume that it will be distributed. Although Oregon is liberalized, the jointer statute, the Oregon Supreme Court has a few minor exceptions consistently construed existing statutes to prevent conceal prior to the completion of all proceedings and actions and suits involving multiple parties and multiple claims. This bill seeks to permit such appeals. Federal Rule 54B addresses itself to this problem, and with a history of 63 years of interpretation of similar rules in the federal court, Rule 54B should be very helpful if Oregon desires to adopt a procedure permitting appeals prior to final determination of the entire proceeding. This requires some revision of existing statutes. That is taken care of in this bill. ORS 18.010 is defined judgment proceeding to be amended to include final judgment entered in multiple parties and multiple claims litigation prior to final determination. The Summary Judgment Act would need to be amended. 18.030, which permits judgments against one or more parties, would be superseded. And ORS 19.010, which defines appealable judgments, would be amended to include final judgments in multiple party and multiple claims actions. Entry of an appealable judgment prior to final disposition of multiple party and multiple claim proceedings would require an express finding that there is no just reason for delay and an express direction for entry of the judgment so that there can be no doubt of the court's intention to enter a final appealable judgment. House Bill 2252 would also permit the court to stay execution of the judgment by the entry of subsequent judgments in the proceedings. I might say that very often, before a proceeding is completed, the judge may make a ruling sustaining a demurrer to a certain cause of action or eliminating one of the parties on a demurrer, which may be very vital, maybe because of financial considerations, to the actual determination of the whole issue. To proceed with that trial, instead of taking that matter up on appeal, may mean that their trial will have to be held against the remaining defendants, and then if it were reversed on appeal, the same trial will come back to be held a second time on the defendants who were eliminated or the causes that may have been eliminated, all of which could have been tried in one proceeding if the appeal had gone through and then come back to be resolved at that time. We recommend the adoption of this legislation not only because of the efficiency of the immediate appeal upon early disposal of claims and multiple claim and multiple part proceedings, but because this legislation clarifies and simplifies the procedure in these proceedings for filing appeals as well as cost bills and supersedious bonds. Under Oregon's current procedure, a judgment may be entered against one of several defendants under ORS 18.030 or on a counterclaim or cross-claim in a summary judgment, and it is possible a prevailing party may execute, and the party against whom the judgment is entered may not even stay such proceedings because a supersedious bond may only be filed after an appeal, and appeal may only be taken after entry of a final judgment, and under our present definition, that determination by the court on the summary judgment would not be a final judgment. On the other side of the question is whether the appellate courts should be burdened with piecemeal appeals. The Oregon Constitution provides the Supreme Court shall have jurisdiction only to revise the final decisions of the circuit courts. We do not believe that this legislation violates this constitutional provision, since our court has already approved appeals where cost bills, accountings, and attorney fees remain to be determined. We also do not believe House Bill 2252 permits piecemeal appeals. If Oregon's procedure permits joinder of several claims and several parties, the denial of a right to appeal judgments entered before all claims are determined would deny to a litigant a right he would have had if the joinder had never been authorized. Joinder does not mean all causes are heard at one trial. It should likewise not require all appeals be decided in one Supreme or appellate court argument. For these reasons, I recommend adoption of this legislation.
Chairman.
Mr. Smith.
That's not this legislature. Past legislatures have refused to adopt their carte blanche set of rules. Is this a decided attempt by the bar, this bill, and interrogatories and others piecemeal to adopt federal rules?
No, I don't think so at all. I personally drafted this bill. I don't feel you should adopt all the federal rules. There are some I feel should be adopted. I do think this much is true. One thing about using a model of something in the federal rules, which is good, is it has a long history of interpretation, and you're not trying to develop some brand new language which you may suddenly discover the court is interpreting differently than everybody who proposed it. So I think it is good to have a model to look at if the legislation is good. I believe this legislation is good, and therefore, if you can find a model which has had a long history of interpretation, then it should be used. And that's exactly what's being done here.
Just a moment, please. Senator Smith, for you?
Yes,
Senator Brown.
On that point, is the language of 54B actually incorporated substantially?
Insofar as it's possible to do so with our different names, I mean, we have causes of action, causes of suit instead of claims and so forth, so there have to be those differences in names, but with those differences, the language is just as close to the federal language as we could possibly do. I might say 54B in the federal rules has a long history before the federal rules were adopted. This particular rule of appeals where there are multiple parties and multiple claims, federal legislation predated the federal rules in this area. So this wasn't something that came in new in the federal courts with the federal rules.
Senator Brown.
But the several amendments that I see in HB 2252, those that appear on page 2, 3, and 4, these are all an effort on your part to distribute 54B throughout this.
To make it consistent in the court so that in the code, so that we're not having conflicting provisions in some other statutes.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Senator Roberts. Mr. Martin, would you just give us from my benefit, and maybe everybody else understands it, a real life situation. A multiple cause, multiple parties, easy understand.
Right.
Multiple cause.
All right, let's say you were suing a principal and an agent in an action, and let's assume, for instance, just to make the thing as a practical matter more realistic, let's assume that, say, the principal had funds or insurance or money or something of that kind. The court ruled early in the game that there was no agency relationship and therefore sustained on a summary judgment proceeding a judgment in favor of the principal. The plaintiff, as far as he's concerned, is then left with proceeding against the agent who may have no money, no funds, nothing of any kind. If he has to try that case, he will still go to the Supreme Court on the other case and come back and have to try the very same factual case except for the agency question all over again. And if that appeal can go up to the court, undoubtedly, the lower court will not continue with that proceeding. They will hold it off pending the appeal. that if the Supreme Court holds that in fact there is no agency, then in fact you would proceed to try the case against the agency. Hold there were, the principal would read back in it, you'd try the whole case at one time, it wouldn't take two trials.
Okay, now that's multiple parties, because...
That's parties,
okay,
yes.
Okay, that's parties. Now what about multiple causes?
Well, you could have two distinct causes of action in which in a case you were making a claim. I'm trying to think of a good illustration where you have two causes of action against one defendant. They could be for various reasons. I don't think it's essential I get a specific thing, but you're suing a defendant on two different causes of action, maybe different theories of a claim in which you could have maybe a tort and a contract theory of attempting to pursue, a lawyer on malpractice case or something of that kind. And one of the causes of action, for some reason, the court sustained a demur to. The evidence would not vary materially on either cause of action, but the court should sustain a demur to one cause of action. If you could appeal from that, that might be a vital cause of action in that case to be tried, and until that appeal was determined, and it was determined whether or not that issue would be tried, you could not dispose of the controversy between the parties. But if that decision of the lower court could go up on appeal, and then the Supreme Court decided whichever way it decided, it would be out of the case or back in it, and if it's back in it, you could try the whole case, and if it's out of it, then there at least wouldn't be any other trial hanging over everybody's head.
Okay. Good question.
The decree entered against the principal in your example would be, quote, a final judgment entered pursuant to Section 3 of this 1977 Act.
It would be a final judgment if the court says it is, just like under the federal rules. And the court has that discretion. I mean, the history of the federal rule—this not only the federal rule, but this preceded the federal rule—the history of the permitting appeals before final determination of all the controversies has been that—and we have that trouble here in Oregon. Very frequently, lawyers are confronted with the problem: should I appeal now or should I not? Can I wait to appeal? Can I appeal? The court has had a great deal of difficulty with this, generally having resolved it against allowing appeal. But what I was going to say here is that when the court labels this a final judgment, that label itself makes it appealable.
Right.
So there never needs to be any controversy over whether it's an appealable judgment. The label of the judge makes it appealable.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Mr. Martin and Greg Kirkpatrick. Larry, do you want to come up at the same time?
Yeah,
I'm just on
this.
Okay. This is on 53 you're taking up now.
Right.
All right. Madam Chairman, if it would be convenient for the committee, I wonder if it would be possible to request that these bills, I think they aren't very controversial, if it's possible to vote on them today. Mr. Martin and I are the only ones from our committee that have worked on these particular bills, and if there were committee questions, I think we'd feel obligated to be here. If it's possible to not set these for work session, if the committee felt comfortable considering it today, it would save us a trip to Portland. If that's not convenient, a trip back down from Portland or from Eugene. If that's not convenient for the committee,
rather than
usual
request.
If we can come back to the work session if there's going to be a work session.
Diane, I understand on 2252 there needs to be an amendment.
Well, just one small one, Madam Chairman. That was in section 1 of the bill. There's one line on line 12, page 2, which says other determinations in a suit, intermediate in nature, are called orders. And I talked with Mr. Kirkpatrick about that this morning. I think that other determinations in both suits and actions at law are called intermediate in nature, are called orders, and we only have that sentence in the suit provision. It should either be added to subsection 1, as well as being in subsection 2, or it should be a separate subsection 3 to read other determinations in a suit or action, intermediate in nature, are called orders. It was just something I think was left over from the old statute that just was not very clear.
What's your recommendation, Mark?
I agree with Diana that it's just simply a problem with the old statute. We just conformed our language to the old statute, but it might be desirable to clear up the ambiguity in the old statute at the same time.
Move the amendment, Madam Chair. Move it. The amendment.
Which one?
Is there any objection? Hearing none, the amendment is adopted.
Step of kind for this version of the amendment.
What's your pleasure with 2262? I move the bill to fully the test of the issue. Any Roberts, please, it do pass. Is there discussion?
Madam Chairman, I want to explain my vote ahead of time. Due deference to the witnesses, and I can appreciate their problem, helping appreciate mine, I'd like some opportunity to consider the bills, and so my intention is to vote no, which should not be interpreted if it does pass as a no vote necessarily on the floor, but I'm sympathetic to their driving down. I hope they're sympathetic to my intention of studying.
Senator Roberts, could we... We have
to
take six bills.
Would
you rather take them up at a
different time? Well, I hate to be a sick in the mud, but
that's all right.
Having been, well, it's not an uncommon position for me to be in. This whole area, the state of Oregon has been moving rather rapidly, although I think the Practice Procedure Committee would probably want to take issue with that. Been moving very rapidly in a number of areas, and I've received nothing but criticism from my colleagues in the bar about stuff we've done in the years past, about joinder and things that I thought were pretty good changes to the law 2 years ago and 4 years ago.
Could we make the motion and hold it until Wally satisfies himself, and he's not satisfied with it, then...
Well, or maybe just go ahead. If I'm the only foot dragger, then I can reach a decision by the time it hits the floor and exercise my...
Do you refer it to committee?
Or that, or you already vote no, and let the thing go on, like the governor worry about it.
Maybe a possibility would be to bring it up on the work session, but let them know that if before we table it or make a major amendment, that we would give them an opportunity to be heard.
Well, the point announced is a work session, and I think it's rather unusual to do a withdrawal motion. The committee members would feel more comfortable taking up the six bills as a package. I think we'll undo it that one.
Maybe we could set a specific time that's convenient for them to take it up.
Can we do it in the morning sometime?
We said our next Wednesday was scheduled. No, we haven't yet. Would that convene?
I could make it happen. It'd be 3 o'clock, I suspect. 3 next Wednesday.
What day? Wednesday. Next Wednesday? I don't have any idea. I'm sorry. I don't have any idea. We both of us need to be here.
As long as you're here.
As long as you're here. As long as you're here. I think that's sufficient.
Well,
I could find to make it at that time.
I withdrew my motion, so there's no motion before the committee anyway, so we'll just have to check with the chairman. Okay, we're on 2253.
Go ahead,
yes.
All right. House Bill 2253 is intended to permit a plaintiff to join all claims he has against the defendant in one action. Oregon has long had restrictive rules regarding joinder of claims. ORS 16.220 of the present joinder statute lists categories of claims that may be joined, and all the claims must fall into one of these categories for joinder to be allowed. These categories are generally derived from the common law forms of action. In 1973, the legislature significantly liberalized ORS 16.220 by authorizing joinder when claims arise out of the both same transaction or transactions or occurrences. However, because of the continued use of categories, joinder of claims falling into different categories is still prohibited unless the claims arise out of these same transaction or transactions or occurrences. Because of the amendment to the counterclaim statute by the 1975 legislature, there is now an inconsistency in Oregon law. A defendant may join and answer any kind of counterclaims he may have against the plaintiff without regard to a category or type of claim, but the plaintiff is restricted in the type of claims that may be joined in a complaint. House Bill 2253 would remove this inconsistency by allowing a plaintiff to join any claims the plaintiff has against the defendant subject to the jurisdiction of the parties of the court. This is the procedure followed in many other states and in the federal courts. Whose legislation is based upon Federal Rule 18. If joinder would be prejudicial or inconvenient or cause undue expense or delay, the court has authority under ORS 11.060 to order the claims to be separated for trial. The bill would permit one borough, for now several would be required.
It should, to that extent, reduce the caseload of the court. I would recommend its adoption.
Okay.
How many, do you have any idea how many cases out there be affected by this?
I don't think there's any way conceivably, you know, because we're talking about cases that weren't going,
yeah.
And so we're talking about something that didn't happen and how much of something would happen if we'd had the law. It's hard to say. I have a case right now that this would make a difference on, and numerous cases during the year where we would join things that we don't join now.
Could you give me some live examples?
We have a defendant in which you have two totally unrelated claims.
Like what? What would you have?
He owes you a bill. He's liable to you on something entirely separate from that.
Okay, I see it in theory. I'm just trying to, well, I'm kind of...
controversies with one person, not involving the same transaction or occurrences. I mean, that's, it's not unusual when two people are ready for litigation that there are other areas besides one particular transaction that they have controversies over.
Well, I suppose one would be, a contract dispute and then maybe a little libel or slander.
Sure.
That is not necessarily
going on. Once people get involved in controversy, they usually think of more than one thing that they're mad at you.
or other things come up to become.
And other things come up just arising from the original dispute, which are not really related to it, but are dredged up because of their general controversies, and they result in several different actions being filed, and it makes, excuse me.
Salt and battery, and just listen to a pleasure ship.
Do you have a question, sir?
Yes, did you run this idea by the bar last
fall? All of these bills had been approved by the Oregon State Bar in the convention held last fall.
Well, what was the vote like, relatively? 2-1, close?
You would know
on
this better than
bill.
This had, as I recall, I'm just speaking from memory, I don't believe there's any opposition to this particular bill. And nobody testified on the House side in opposition to this bill. Its effect is relatively minor in light of the broadening of the joint provisions in the past. If there's just one small remaining area where joint provision allows. So, to my knowledge, nobody spoke in support against it, and there was not even a hand vote. And
it's going to create quite a hardship for people taking the bar exam for the second or third time. Learned it the other way before.
Put an effective date on it after.
The only solution is limited bar
exams. I have some problems with this one from two or three standpoints. First of all, if you've got two or three areas of litigation against a person and you file them all in the same complaint, it may give you an edge on negotiating out one or two of them. And saying, okay, so we've got you on the contract, and we've got you on the bad debt, and we've got you on libel. We're willing to drop one, but we're going to proceed with the other two, or something or other. That's one problem. The second problem is in the trial, you're going to have two or three separate trials on the facts so that you can keep each cause of action, each claim, separate in the minds of the jurors.
Sometimes
judges and the witnesses and everybody else. Are you going to get them all running in there on the bad debt and the next one's on the breach contract and the next one's on something else? And
sometimes you will and sometimes you won't. Frequently, I mean, attorneys can agree on both sides that they would much prefer, and so would the court, to have them all tried in one trial. In fact, all cases, of course, aren't tried to the jury, and whether you want to get a whole set of different instructions for different things, I think could be that kind of a problem. But trying it before the court certainly would not take any separate trials. Trying some cases...
Well, I didn't mean really separate trials, but in a sense, that's what you're doing. If you have to separate them out, you've got to have witnesses here on the breach contract. They may be different witnesses than on the bad debt. Then you've got to have other witnesses on the other, whatever else it is.
What frequently happens, though, in these controversies, people essentially may have the same witnesses, even though they're over slightly different controversies. and they are running the courts in separate times to testify.
Okay, I wouldn't have any problems with the bill if it was a joinder of complaints arising out of the same incident.
That's what the current law is. That's the current law.
Okay. Why then have you, let me, this question. In subsection 2, you refer to one kind of action, FED, and an action for rental due. You've indicated that the time for appearance is that is for the recovery of rental due. There must be in a lot of other statutes other kinds of time for appearance. Maybe there's not. Maybe it's the only
one. I think this forcible entry detainer and the rental thing has been carried along in the law for some time because we have the special FED procedure. I don't think there are that many different kinds of procedure in the law where you have that kind of problem.
What's the difference in the time for an appearance in an FED and the rental
due? It's 10 days in regular action, and FED, as I recall, is either 3 to 5 days, something like that. It's very short in an FED, and it's much longer in 10 days in a regular circuit court action. Unless you're served out of state or something.
The FED is depends on how it's served, as I recall that other bill we had.
Yeah.
Whether it's served in person or whether it's posted on the door or
yeah.
Something like that. Yeah.
Although we're going to make that a little more uniform by that bill that's carried on.
It was simply intended to maintain the status quo on this part of the law.
Right.
This is simply the existing law. We're not making any changes with regard to that procedure.
This has always been in the law as the amendments have gone through on joinder. The forcible entry, detainer, and rentals have always been a problem because of their different times, and they've always had the distinction made in the statute. We haven't changed that. This isn't something new. This is just maintaining part of the present statute.
If I could perhaps give an example of the remaining area that's not covered. The existing law says all claims arising out of the same transaction or transactions, so that sweeps very broadly. Or then, if it doesn't fall into that category, it falls into categories having the same types of injuries, like all claims involving injury to person, regardless of how many happening at different times, in fact, it didn't matter how the transaction, same transaction can join them. So if a neighbor comes over and assaults you 1 week, comes over and assaults you the next week, you can join those. Those are the same type of injuries. But the neighbor comes over 1 week and assaults you, the next week comes over and damages your property, and the next week comes over and slanders you, those are three different types of injuries. Those can't be joined, whereas they're all the same type of injury they could, and it just doesn't seem to make a lot of sense if they are properly joinable for the court not to allow it. This is purely a permissive joinder. It's not mandatory in any way. If the court feels they can't be joined and they should be tried separately, fine, that's the way they would be. It's only in cases where there would be no prejudice that results and the court finds they can be conveniently tried together. Otherwise, 11060 allows the court to sever it for trial. So it's all purely a permissive statute in those cases where the parties and the court agree that it would be more convenient and would save time and not be prejudicial.
Okay,
other
questions? Senator,
yeah, this is a bill that Harney has setting up a commission for changes in civil procedure.
That is passed out of the House Judiciary Committee before Ways and Means at the present time.
And what does that do specifically?
That would simply create a council that would have ongoing rulemaking authority to keep Oregon's procedures up to date, to look at Oregon procedure and have authority to get them.
It's more than that. To keep them up to date, if you assume modernization, change, all this sort of stuff. It has the authority.
Right.
Rewrite the whole civil procedure code subject to being undone by the legislature. So this broader sweeping change, the potential broader sweeping change, as already has ever seen since the DD code, I suspect, if the council chooses to make it. But it's delegating to the council all the things that you two gentlemen in this committee have been working on for years and years and years piecemeal. So it's not, I don't know whether it's not a simple little measure. It's potentially far-reaching depending on who they put on it. If it may not be any change or maybe a lot of change.
Depending on the council and the assessment of the state of Colorado.
Move from the Supreme Court to the council.
Yes.
Pardon?
The other bill was the Supreme Court.
We've seen that bill almost biennially for
the
team.
The
very
effective
is
council.
Are there other questions on 2253?
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
Apologies, I was outside for just a minute, but have the concerns of Mr. Jennings been addressed?
Yes, that letter was sent to the House Judiciary Committee also. It was brought up by the House Judiciary Committee and considered there. The problem wouldn't be a problem, and I personally talked to Mr. Jennings about it, if 2254 is also passed. It is necessary. These bills are being presented to you as joint parties, and joint plaintiff bills do complement each other. And so if they're intended to be submitted as a package, and if two bills are submitted as a package, it solves the problem Mr. Jennings raises. If not, we need to make one minor amendment to 2254.
Okay, let's go to 2254.
2254 is intended to permit several plaintiffs to join the plaintiffs in an action or suit where they are seeking recovery for their individual claims arising out of the same transaction or occurrence. The 75 legislature amended 13116 intending to achieve this result, but unfortunately allows joinder only if plaintiffs having an interest in the subject of the suitor action and in obtaining the relief demanded. Courts in other states construing similar language have held that if the plaintiffs are seeking separate recovery of damages, they do not have an interest in obtaining the relief demanded and therefore cannot be joined. Although no Oregon appellate case has been as yet construed the amended version of 13.160, there is sufficient danger that it will not accomplish its intended purpose, authorizing permissive joinder of plaintiffs in actions at law. House Bill 2254 is similar to a Federal Rule 20. It thus has the advantage of a body of federal case law construing this provision. The proposed legislation authorizes a joinder of plaintiffs if they assert any right to release jointly, severally, or in the alternative, in respect to or arising out of the same transaction occurrence or series of transaction or occurrences, and if any question of law or fact common to all these persons will arise in the action. The bill thus addresses another problem of joinder. Under existing Oregon law, if the plaintiff is uncertain which of two defendants is responsible for his injuries, it is generally not possible to sue the defendant in the alternative. House Bill 2255 authorized the assertion of a claim against defendants in the alternative. The bill would result in the consolidation of claims into one trial instead of two or three. It is permissive, so no plaintiff should be required to join. I recommend it.
Senator Kapoor?
Why do you have these different bills?
I suppose there's no real reason other than that's the way they were drafted and submitted. My own feeling is the two do go together, particularly the last two. The first one has some different considerations. These last two, I think, should have a joint consideration by the committee.
We'll join you right here.
Right. That's the place we're joining the first
one. And is it permissive with the court? The court has a discretion.
Yes.
Where is that discretion given to the court, just out of curiosity?
You mean to try them separately?
No, to require them to be separate all day.
I don't think it's permissive in the sense the court could say we will not allow the joiner, but I think the court could say we'll have separate trials.
Further questions? Thank you very much.
Wednesday, it would be fine now if the committee were receptive to having a work session on the discovery bill.
I think they wanted to have more time on the bills, is my understanding, and that next Wednesday would be more satisfactory to the committee members. The House bills, so.
We can find a representative.
Can you make Wednesday?
I can, and we'll try to have whoever the committee needs, depending on what bills are considered. All 66 bills, that's fine. We'll be here.
Fine.
Diana, can we get to you?